The year is 1768. Alan Trevisco, a young maritime insurance clerk at Lloyd's Coffee House, has been retained by his employer to investigate the possible murder of a client. After enlisting the help of Dr. Erasmus Merwood, a respected physician, the two repair to the London home of Merwood's friend Mr. John Hunter, a Scottish surgeon famous for originating the study of anatomical pathology. Mr. Hunter makes arrangements to have the client's grave robbed, so that an autopsy might be performed. Mr. John Hunter actually existed. All the other characters are fictional, but this fragment is based on an eyewitness account of an actual grave robbery.
Alan, awake. 'Tis time. Dr. Merwood gently prodded Trevisco's shoulder. The body lifters are arrived. Trevisco's dream slowly evaporated. He stood up from the couch where he had been sleeping. The room was lit with a few fine wax candles, much less malodorous than the tallow candles that Trevisco could afford, and suffused the room in flickering amber light. Finally, shaking the sleep from his eyes, he reached for his hat and sword belt. Merwood pressed a purse into his hand. "In case you have need of it, the Grabs are not accustomed to be paid before the body is delivered, but if you should find yourself in trouble, money is a resource not to be scoffed at." Trevisco weighed the purse in his hand. It must have contained 20 or 30 guineas.
"Are you not coming, sir?"
he asked, the implication of the gift finally registering. "No, nor Mr. Hunter," Merwood replied. "The presence of anyone known to be interested in anatomy on such an excursion ought to put it in danger."
"Danger?
Now how should the St. Catherine Cree Charlie react, were he to see two medicos in a cart, bearing a human-sized sack, hurrying away? I'll tell you, Alan, he would raise an alarm." Trevisco suddenly nodded. He simply did not believe he was actually about to participate in a grave-robbing expedition. The entire idea was too outré. Hunter met them at the door, where he stood in the presence of two ragged-looking men, one upwards of 50 and the other scarcely older than an adolescent. He took one look at Trevisco and scowled.
"That will no do, sir. Let me get you a neckerchief to hide your bony face."
He wrapped a black woolen square around Trevisco's face, a less appropriate furnishing in the late sultry summer Trevisco could not conceive, and stood back, pleased with the effect.
"Mr. Trevisco, allow me to present Mr. Burris and Mr. Ware," Hunter said, his face alight with glee.
"But why must I go along?" Trevisco pleaded, as the gravity of the situation asserted itself. He was starting to wake.
"Why, so that we may be assured that the proper like is brought back," Hunter said. "Mr. Burris is a sound man of business, but to him one corpse is very much like another."
Burris laughed, exposing a gap-toothed grin that reminded Trevisco unpleasantly of the catacombs in Rome. Ware's look was one of cool appraisal. Resigning himself to this unpleasant adventure, Trevisco nodded, clapped his hat on his head, and ventured out into Jermyn Street. A mule-drawn cart stood waiting, a man midway between Burris and Ware in years at the reins, looking bored and disreputable by the torchlight.
"Who's the cove with the spit, then?" the driver asked of Burris.
"He's the carrot's cub along for the bite,"
Burris replied. He pointed to Trevisco's small sword and said,
"You may want to leave the poker behind. Looks a mite suspicious, if you know what I mean, sir."
"I should feel more comfortable were I to keep it," said Trevisco.
Burris shrugged, and Ware smirked. Burris gestured to the driver, saying,
"This here's Mr. Favor. Meet Mr. Trevisco, Ned."
Favor nodded curtly as Trevisco, Burris, and Ware climbed into the cart. Three hogshead covered by a canvas tarpaulin stood on the bed.
"Leadenhall Street, Ned, St. Catherine Cree," instructed Burris.
"Right."
Favor flicked the reins and the mule plodded eastward. Burris scrutinized Trevisco's face, and the tense visage he saw there made him cackle.
"There's no call to be sitting on thorns, sir. 'Twill all be as easy as pissing the bed, wait and see. We'll be in and out of the autumn yard with the quorums afore you can say Jack Robinson, without no colour wake to the ground sweat being so much as touched."
Burris winked conspiratorially.
"The sexton at St. Catherine Cree Church is a beano cuff, once he's been greased in the fist. I saw that old ningimer with the cauliflower tip you the balsam for the daub, so 'twill be all rug."
Trevisco's look of anxiety was replaced by one of incomprehension.
I fear I haven't understood near half of what you have just said, Mr. Burris."
Ware snorted.
"He don't know any St. Giles's Greek, Bob."
Burris laughed again.
"No, he don't. I'll be his cobbler with Diggory, then."
"St. Giles's Greek?"
"Peddler's French. Flash lingo, cart," Burris said. If you want to deal with a cunting crew, sir, 'tis best you learn it, or you're like to be bitten."
Trevisco nodded nervously. "I shall look forward to augmenting my education, Mr. Burris."
"Now, sir, we're off to the autumn, that's a church. There we will fetch the quarrooms, the corpse, sir, from the ground sweat, meaning his grave, that is. Old Diggory, what's a sexton, will be wanting you to grease his fist, meaning to bribe him like, and to look the other way. A ningimmer is a doctor, and a cauliflower is that big full-bottom wig he wears. Balsam is money, and the daub, that's a bribe itself. Old rug means 'twill all be well."
Burris cackled again, clearly relishing his role as tutor.
"Dr. Merwood called you a body lifter, then a grab. I take it these are words from St. Giles's Greek to describe your profession? You said you'd be a cobbler."
"A cobbler ain't the same. That only means I'll be translating the camp for you. As to our calling, well, we're called all manner of names," admitted Burris.
"Sack 'em up, men, for one. Someone once called us a crew of body snatchers."
He laughed raucously, and Ware in favor joined him.
"Why is that so amusing?" Trevisco asked. "Why, a body snatcher's a bum bailiff, isn't he?" declared Favor. "Can you think a bum bailiff would ever cloy a grin for a glass case? Rich, that is."
"Cloy a grin for a glass case?"
"Steal a body for the sergeant to automize," translated Burris, grinning. "Aye, we're called all manner of names, sir. But as we raise mortal remains from the grave, as it were, we should be called something more high-sounding. I always like to think of myself as a resurrectionist."
"A resurrectionist," Trevisco repeated, suppressing a shiver. It was a word he had never heard before, but would certainly hear again.
"Very droll."
Favor parked the cart in an alley behind the churchyard. Lifting the tarpaulin, Burris's crew each took hold of a short wooden spade, and Ware grabbed a lantern and an amount of sacking. Favor gathered up the canvas. Burris lifted a coil of rope with iron hooks attached at each end and put it over his shoulder. They skulked to the churchyard gate, where Burris gently knocked. Diggory, fright plain on his face, slowly pulled the gate open, wincing as the hinges moaned. The lantern's beam exposed a well-kept graveyard, some of the tombstones covered with lichen, the carvings on them slightly eroded by the elements.
"Rye, then. The Charlie's back in an hour," he whispered.
"See here, Diggs," Burris said urgently, taking Diggory by the arm and leading him away from the others into the pitch black. "We can have a cove with a Dagon bobbed, and 'tis more cly for us all. He's a right Ben, and had no part of the cold cook's soap, so the dustman is worth a caravan to him. I told him you expected to."
Diggory nodded vigorously.
"Mr. Trevisco, this here's Ted Diggory," Burris said.
"How much then, Diggs?"
"Five guineas?"
Trevisco frowned. It was too dark to judge their intentions from their faces, but he had heard enough to arouse suspicion. He felt his heart beat in his chest. These were dangerous men. He slapped the hilt of his small sword, and Burris twitched in surprise.
"Why so startlish, Mr. Burris? Mayhap your nervosity has some reason, beyond the task at hand, I mean."
"Why, no, sir."
"Are you certain? Although St. Giles's Greek be Greek to me, Mr. Burris, where Homer's Greek ain't, you might take more care that the words you choose to confound me should actually do so."
Trevisco could tell by his shoulders that Burris was attempting a disarming grin. He was grateful that he didn't have to see the ghoulish gap-toothed smile again.
"I can't think of what you be driving at, sir."
Can you not? The cove with the Dagon may be a right Ben, but then again, might not be so Benish as you presume,"
Trevisco bluffed. It had not been difficult to assume that the cove with the Dagon was the same as the cove with the spit.
"It did not escape my notice, Mr. Burris, that you were at some pains to determine whether or no I was conversant in your peddler's French. Now why should you so bother yourself?"
"Because, Mr. Burris, the cant is naught but speech, whereby the class of misfeasors might avoid having their intentions apprehended by more lawful persons. You wanted to know if you could give instructions to your confederates without I should understand them. But a sop to Cerberus is not confined to flash lingo as describing a bribe. The phrase has been in use for many years, and is not limited to the mouths of villains. You betrayed that Mr. Diggory has already been bribed with regard to the reliquiae of the late Mr. Sprode. Your object in this deception was surely the purse of Calabash, as I believe you called it, that you knew to be on my person. Do you mean to have it by any means?"
"Be very careful how you go, Mr. Trevisco," Burris said menacingly. There are three of us and only one of you.
Burris,
hissed Diggory.
Not here, not in the churchyard. It'll be the three-legged horse for certain.
Should you make so far as to the gallows? Don't be a fool, said Trevisco, his blood roaring in his ears.
I am the one with the poker, or the spit, or the dagon, or whatever you are pleased to call my small sword, and the one who knows how to use it. You would not care to be pinked, I trow. Even if you could overpower me, there's the certainty of losing Mr. Hunter's custom for ever should I not return. Whatever I have in this purse is not worth the loss of your livelihood, surely.
Burris rubbed his chin.
There are other sergeants.
Trevisco laughed. It was a forced, false laugh that carried no conviction in his own ears. He hoped Burris would be fooled.
Aye, but they are all colleagues. What one knows, every one of them shall learn, and sooner than later.
Burris swayed, struggling with himself.
But I may yet part with some of the calabash, Trevisco suggested, if you tell me who the cold cook is, and why he should arrange to have Sprode's grave violated.
How much? Burris demanded. A guinea to every man here. Burris jerked his head in a nod of assent.
Done. Tell him, Diggs.
Diggory heaved a sigh of relief.
A cold cook is the undertaker, sir. 'Twas the undertaker wanted the job done, and this very Darkman's, so I called on Burris here to make sure it was done proper.
You intended to rob this grave even before Mr. Hunter contacted you? Trevisco asked Burris.
Aye. Nor should I haul it so far as Jermyn Street if he had not sent for me. As I said, there are other surgeons in Mr. Hunter.
But why did the undertaker want it done tonight?
He'd already been paid to get it done, hadn't he?
Diggory said.
The nephew sold him the quorums, didn't he? A rum cove, that one. Wanted to get as much cly out of the square toes as he could.
Mr. Caustic sold his own uncle's body?
That's it, sir.
Now, a canary bird every man, interjected Burris.
What?
A guinea each was the bargain. Trevisco nodded. A guinea for every man, upon our safe return to Jermyn Street. I shall take care of Mr. Diggory whilst you proceed with our business here. Grumbling, Burris joined his crew at the gravesite while Trevisco paid Diggory. Joining the men, Trevisco saw that they had spread out the tarpaulin on the earth next to the grave. The lantern provided just enough light for the men to dig by.
Wooden spades, explained Faber. All snug with them. Less noise and iron when we strikes the box.
To Trevisco's surprise, they did not uncover the entire plot, but dug close to the headstone, clearing only as much of the rest of the grave as was necessary to continue their downward progress. They scrupulously placed each shovel of dirt on the canvas. The progress was incredibly rapid. In less than 20 minutes they struck the coffin. The two hooks were lowered and wedged firmly under the lid on opposite sides. They dropped the sacks on top of the lid, and then all three heaved mightily on the rope. The crack of the lid breaking open was slightly muffled by the sacking atop it, but all of them paused to listen for several seconds before continuing. Ware pulled the sacks out, and Trevisco could see that the upper portion of the lid had broken off, its lower end sawtoothed with jagged splinters. The sunken cheeks of Lionel Sprode were shadowed in the dim lamplight. Unceremoniously, Burris and Faber seized the body by the shoulders and dragged it out of the coffin. They immediately began to strip him.
"Why are you removing his clothes?" Trevisco asked. "They won't need him, and we don't want them to be known by him," said Burris impatiently. "Back in the box they go."
"Wait!" Trevisco took Sprode's coat and rolled it into a bundle.
"Don't be totty-headed," Burris hissed. "If we're caught with that, it could be a ride backwards up Auburn Hill for us."
"They don't hang men for stealing corpses," Trevisco said.
"They do for stealing fine coats."
"Nevertheless, I intend to keep it." Burris gave Trevisco an angry look, but turned away. Ware and Faber had stuffed Sprode's body into one of the sacks, while Burris coiled the rope. The rest of Sprode's clothing was shoved back into the coffin, the lid put roughly back in place, and then they began to fill in the hole. 20 minutes later, when Faber folded the tarpaulin, the grave appeared exactly as it had when they had begun.
"Help us with the goods,"
Burris ordered Trevisco, and the four of them lifted the absurdly light sack. Trevisco had expected a dead man to weigh heavily, and carefully carried Sprode through the gate to the cart, where the mule stood patiently waiting. Trevisco heard the gate moan shut behind them as they deposited the body on the cart's bed. There was no amusing conversation on the slow plod back to Jermyn Street. Hunter and Merwood met them at the door,
standing aside as they carried the sack up to Hunter's dissecting room. Hunter gave Burris a small purse, the price having been arranged beforehand, and only then did Trevisco award the 3 guineas he had promised them, avoiding Burris's evil glare as he crossed his palm with the glinting gold coin. When the door closed behind them, Trevisco felt a surge of relief, and an equally strong feeling of sudden fatigue wash over him. But his gorge started as he remembered that the grisliest part of the dark morning still lay before them. He sat on the couch that had served him as a bed earlier that night, and rubbed his eyes.